welcome. My name is Wes Granberg Michelson, and this is a seminar on titled Leadership from Inside Out. That's the place where you found yourself. I need to apologize at the outset because I've been fighting a bad head cold for about the past 2 days, so you can hear me better than I can hear myself. So if you don't understand anything, please let me know. It's it is interesting that the organizers of the symposium wanted a seminar on leadership. I mean, this is really not about worship per se, but it's about what is essential in the life of any church if your worship life is going to have any real meaning and power and integrity to it. So we're really talking about from a biblical and a Christian understanding, how do we think about the qualities of leadership, and when we say leadership, that can mean leadership of a whole denomination. It can mean leadership of a college. It can mean leadership in a congregation. It can mean leadership of a consistory. It can mean leadership of a worship team. At literally any level, the kinds of things I'll be talking about have the same applicability. The way I'd like to start is to tell a story about our director of church multiplication. I should say, if those of you don't know, my particular role is called General Secretary in the Reformed Church in America, which is a very good title, because half the church wants me to be a general and half the church wants me to be a secretary, and my job is to sort of figure out how to do that. But my director of our director of church multiplication came in and talked to me a few months ago and said he had been at a seminar with Bob Logan, who's kind of one of the new church growth gurus, and a guy named Tom Clegg. And this was being done by CoachNet, if any of you know that kind of network. And they undertook a study called Missing in America. And it was a study of 300 church plants that failed. So they wanted to look at, what happens in the life of these attempted church plants that fail, so they could learn from them. This was church plants over a 5-year period. The conclusion that they came to was this, that in about 15 to 16 of those 300 cases, the church plant had failed because the skills and competencies of the leader were not sufficient. And in the other about 280 cases, the church plant had failed because of issues in the life of the leader, that either questions of morality, questions of marriage, questions of physical health, of depression, of legal trouble, of family trouble, of conflict with others. So that in 280 out of 300 failed new church plants, the reason for the failure had not to do with competency or skill, but had to do with what you would call the inner qualities of the life of the leader. And that's probably best explains the way I like to think about and encourage others like you to think about this question of leadership. If you go to Amazon.com and type in books on leadership, I did this the other night again. I do this periodically. Last time I did this, I came up with 6,243 books. Right. I mean, everyone is writing about leadership. Most of what people write are about leadership techniques, how to be a leader, you know, the 7 most important things or the 5 things to remember or, you know, what you learned from the Dalai Lama and how you apply the leadership of Genghis Khan to today's organizations. Or, I mean, you go to Borders and you look at books on leadership, and it is all over the map. There's an amazing array of stuff, but most of it is kind of how to. And that stuff is interesting. I happen to like that stuff. You know, it's insightful. And you know, if we are reformed people, we believe that you draw from the wisdom of the wider society. You know, there's only one truth, the God's truth, the truth of Scripture is reflected in the search for truth in the world. And there's a lot you can learn. There's a lot you can learn about leadership. But the emphasis on technique, the emphasis on how to, I think is the wrong starting point. I think for us in thinking about leadership, you start with who the person is. You start with the inner qualities of the leader. You talk in an initial sense not about doing, but about being. Because the first concern of any leader is how you care for your soul. How you care for the intentionality of your inward life. How you care for those things that have made you uniquely who you are before God. And those things that are to be developed and nurtured and blossomed into the full character that God intends for you. Anyone who is given any level of responsibility for others in the life of the church, any level of responsibility, you know, I mean, the leader of a small group, facilitator of a worship team, that responsibility carries with it a real priority to care most deeply about who you are before Christ. And to nurture that sense of your own identity, and to figure out the ways in which you best do that. And there's no one right way to do so, because how one nurtures one's inner life is going to be a product of one's temperament, product of how one is wired. Whether one's an introvert or an extrovert, you know, whether one is fed a lot by interaction with other people, or whether one's fed by times alone, a whole series of things. In all the study of spiritual formation today, it's very, very clear that patterns of spiritual formation, or what classically we've called spiritual discipline, need to fit the kind of inner qualities of the person. I mean, I'll take myself as an example. You know, if I take the Myers-Briggs, I always come out pretty close between an E and an I, but the I will be slightly stronger, which simply means if you know this, you know, there are a bunch of tools like this. But if you know what that means, it means that it doesn't mean that you don't like people. I mean, my goodness, in my work, I'm constantly around people all the time, interacting with people, and I like people. But if I need to draw energy for my soul, I'm going to want to go off to a retreat center and spend a day by myself. And I try to do that like 10 times a year, and then twice a year I go on a retreat for like 3 days, just because of how I'm wired. a person who's an extrovert who really gets energy from talking with other people, that person, in order to really deepen their life, they're going to want to have a group that they could always talk to share their soul most deeply and to be accountable to. And of course, these things are never an either or, but you have to find the things that most fit who you are. There's a book I read recently about kind of seven paths of spiritual life, and in our own worship symposium here, the way some people are drawn to the more mystical and the more transcendent aspects of worship. That's what sort of feeds their soul. I mean, there are some people. I've got a friend. In fact, he was a former director of church multiplication. He is closest to God when he is on the Pere Marquette River, and that's absolutely true. I mean, that's what he will do in order to get, to kind of restore his relationship to Christ. But you find the particular path, but the important thing is that it has to be intentional. It does not happen automatically, especially in this society. No growth of who you are as an individual, the blossoming of your gifts of a leader, it will never just happen. It's got to be shaped and formed by intentional practice and discipline. And you've got to figure out what are those practices and disciplines that best do that for you. Now, I'm going to move through things here until about 10:30, 10:35, and then have time for interaction. At least that's what I would hope. What are the key vulnerabilities to leadership? I mean, what are the key things that are going to cause any of us in this room to lose their effectiveness as a leader? Again, these don't have to do with techniques and styles and learnings and all of that, although all that stuff is important. But are the three things that will have the potential to destroy your own capacity as a leader? It's how you relate to money, how you relate to sex, and how you relate to power. And those are classic. Those are hardly original with me. It's not only Richard Foster, but it goes all the way back to the Middle Ages in the church. Classically, people are shaped and formed in their spiritual life over issues of how they relate to money, how they relate to sex, how they relate to power. Now you think about this. In the Middle Ages, if you joined a monastery or you joined a convent, what are the three vows that you take? Poverty, chastity, and obedience. Which deal with what? Money, sex, and power. I mean, this is old wisdom in the life of the church. Now, those three ways of dealing with this are not happily the only responses. And within the Reformed tradition, the response to dealing with the issue of money is to really internalize the truth that all we have is God's gift, that the response of all our life is a life of gratitude back to God for all we have given that we don't deserve, and that within our tradition is what hopefully unlocks the key around the unbelievable pressure in society to make our lives prisoners to money. And around sex, the response within the Calvinist, within the Reformed, and the broader Christian tradition, but as a response against the monastic movement, is a response that says sexuality is God's gift within the context of covenanted love. And in fact, the Reformation made a great contribution in talking about the giftedness and the joy of sexuality within that covenanted relationship. And within power, the particular contribution that comes from this strain of the of the Christian tradition is that power is not exercised hierarchically. In other words, no, we don't believe in those systems. That, I mean, and you know, you can solve the issue of power by simply giving one person all the power, and that is, I mean, that is one way. It's not a way that's very effective in today's society, particularly because of the communications revolution. Even those organizations who say they are hierarchical, I mean, even when I meet with my colleagues who are bishops or presiding bishops in the Episcopal Church, bishops in the Catholic Church, I mean, you know, none of them think they actually have hierarchical power when you talk to how they get things done, you know. But particularly in our own the tradition out of which many of us here are fed, power is dealt with in a collegial way. You deal with the issue of power by being accountable in collegial assemblies. Now there are different responses to money, sex, and power from different Christian traditions. But the key thing is that in your life, if you're a leader, if you are not figuring out how in your formation as a person, you are dealing with each of those key human realities, each of those things that are intended as God's gifts, but each of those which can be tremendously misused and can distort one's relationships. If you're not dealing with that, you're going to make yourself highly vulnerable to failing as a leader. When I deal with church conflicts, the situations where, you know, it's a huge dispute, congregations splitting, pastors leaving, I don't know if I can literally think of a case that does not involve either money or sex or power. And sometimes more than one. So the kind of, I mean, if you're going kind of in progression here, I'd say attentiveness to your soul, dealing with those ever-present temptations, and shaping your life in such a way that you can respond in God's intended ways to in each of those areas. And then I'd say being tremendously attentive to how God has created you. To really good leaders are people who have spent time understanding how God has wired them. Who they uniquely are. And this is true. This is just a truth that bears itself out in society. The Gallup organization is an organization at the Reformed Church, we've worked with them a lot. We've worked with them in developing ways of assessing people who have the gifts to be new church development pastors. The Gallup organization has something called the Strength Finders. I don't know if any of you have seen or used that. Every one of our staff have gone through a Gallup Strength Finder. You go into our office, and there'll be a little plaque on just about everyone's desk that will identify their five top, what Gallup calls their five top strengths, which are kind of the areas where they're kind of, you know, they most enjoy operating in these areas. There are lots of tools that do this, but when Gallup did a study of 5,000 executives who were running large organizations and asked them what was most helpful to them. You know, it ended up, I mean, it wasn't Lee Iacocca. it wasn't, in fact, all the technique stuff. But their answer is that the thing in the end that helped them most was self-knowledge and self-awareness. And so that, as I say, I mean, this is... I mean that's a biblical insight, but it just proves true even in the broader society. You effective leaders are people who have really spent the time in knowing who they are, and then living and leading out of that. And that allows oneself to be what Edmund Friedland calls a self-differentiated leader. Of all the stuff that I've read on leadership, the single most helpful thing to me was a book given to me when I started as General Secretary by a Jewish rabbi whose name was Edmund Friedman. It was called Generation to Generations. And it actually, you hardly even find it as on a bookshelf as books about leadership per se. It's actually a study of how religious systems operate, and it takes its cue from family systems therapy. And if you, some of you are nodding, some of you people know all the work around family systems that was, who were the pioneers?
Bowen.
Yeah. They really created all the kind of thinking about analyzing, you know, you don't just analyze an individual, but you analyze how does an individual function psychologically and emotionally within a family system, because we all live within these family systems. Well, then this rabbi, Edwin Friedman, very, very insightful guy, took that work and said, you know, I think that synagogues, and then I think that congregations, function like family systems. And so you got to understand how leadership functions within these kinds of systems. And so Friedman's work, some of you are probably heard of him, or I see a few of you nodding. Friedman really emphasizes the way in which the best leaders are people who become self-differentiated persons. And you say, what does that mean? Here's a shorthand, and you know you could go into any of this stuff more in depth. But a self-differentiated person is a person who's able to take a stand in an emotionally intense system. Okay, I mean a person who, you know, when there's all kinds of high intense emotions going on, and people. Back and forth from one another. It's a person who's able to say, well, no, I think this. You know, here I'm not just swayed by the last person I talked to. You know, a leader who always agrees with the last person they talked to is not an effective leader. You know, a self-differentiated leader is a person who's able to put his or her foot down in a particular place and take a stand. Differentiated leader doesn't react to others' reactivity. I don't know. There's maybe nothing I could stress more than that in my experience. And I hope you understand what it means. Don't react to others' reactivity. When you're in certain positions of leadership, or if I take a personal example, anyone who's a leader, in some sense, ends up being towards others a kind of embodiment and a projection of whatever they lead. So if you're a pastor of a church, you can't help but kind of carry the meaning of that church to other people. So when other people interact to you, if they can't stand the church, they're going to have problems with you. If they love the church, they're going to like you. And this may have little to do with you, but they bring that. When I walk into a room of people who are in the Reformed Church in America, if there are people who are really upset about something going on in the Reformed Church in America, they're not going to like me. And if there are people who think what we are doing is terrific, they're going to think I walk on water. And you know, none of that has any objective meaning, but it's true because you know, people bring that into their expectations of leaders. Now the issue is when you have the people who don't like you, and anyone who is a leader has people who don't like them. If you spend all your time reacting to the intense reactions of others who don't like you, you won't be an effective leader. If I spent all my time staying up at night worrying about the emails and letters that come from people who are so upset with something that has happened, and if I'm going to spend all my time, oh my gosh, how am I going to make them happy? Well, in the end, I'm not going to make them happy. I mean, I need to listen. You know, I need to respond. But if I'm simply reacting to the person that raises the loudest cry of discontent and frustration, you know, you end up, in a way, simply reinforcing it. So that a good leader, a self-differentiated leader, learns how to not react to the reactivity of others. Another analogy is that, you know, you don't take the bait. You don't take the bait. And this is very hard to do. I mean, when someone comes at you and says, you know, just attacks you for reasons that are totally off the wall, you know, for you to respond back emotionally to them, in the end, simply reinforces them. So it's a okay, the third thing, and this is a phrase that Friedman coined, a self-differentiated leader learns how to be a non-anxious presence. And that phrase has gained a lot of currency now, but I still think it's one of the best. And if you want, I mean, I'll tell you, and without getting into politics, I'll tell you an example of one of the many reasons why I think Obama won this election. You think about the way he was able to project a non-anxious presence, a steadiness, a clarity. He, you know, not constantly reacting to everything that was thrown at him. Even within this present economic crisis, you know. And one of the most important things he has to do now is say, we are in a terrible situation, but he's got to show that he's grounded. We're going to get through this. He's clear. You know, if he projects, oh my gosh, what in the world are we going to do? Why? 280 million people are going to say the same thing. It's the same way with the pastor in the church. You know, if you project a sense of this is terrible, everything is falling apart, the congregation is going to believe this is terrible, everything is falling apart. So in any situation of high conflict and anxiety, being able to project a non-anxious presence becomes key. Not being a part of a system's emotional dominoes. It's the same kind of pattern. You know, when you look at family systems or look at congregational systems or look at a, you know, this can be a conflict that you have within a worship group of six people. All right? And you've got one person bouncing off of another person back and forth, you know, and they begin attacking, back and forth in huge conflict. Well, you know, you've got to break that pattern. You've got to break that pattern and not be part of a system of emotional, what you call emotional dominoes. And then being, a couple other things, being clear about your own values and goals. Within any situation, say, here are the values that I'm going to be guided by. Here are the values that I think, you know, as a whole, we should be guided by. And finally, you take responsibility for your own emotional well-being, and you don't blame the system. You don't blame the congregation. You don't blame the group. You don't blame the denomination for why you are so unhappy or why you are so anxious or why you can't sleep enough. I mean, the last thing the congregation needs to hear or the last thing your worship team needs to hear is, I am just so distraught because of the conflict we have. I mean, that does nothing. You know, you're responsible for your own emotional well-being. But those kinds of when you bring those kinds of qualities into any group that you lead, you're far better able to give enough emotional stability and clarity within the group to lead it through conflict and to be able to help it to focus on the goals and the mission that it most needs to. Now, but again, what I talked about is kind of care for your soul, vulnerabilities, self-knowledge, self-differentiated leadership. There comes to be, obviously, a deeper spiritual level to all this. You know, I mean, how can you be this kind of person? And what does it take at the level of your inner being to kind of do any of this? And here I want to leave you with just one quote from Henry Nouwen, and it's interesting that we're dealing with the parable of the prodigal son. In a lot of Henry's writings, he speaks at one point about what it really means to be the beloved, and what it really means to know how deeply you are embraced, and how deeply you are loved. He uses, in this particular passage, he's talking about Christ's baptism, but he also reflects on the same things in his short book, The Return of the Prodigal. It's the same thing. And it's the difference between self-knowledge, which I think is terribly important, but beneath self-knowledge is a saving knowledge of one's soul. Self-knowledge is at one level, and a saving knowledge of one's soul is at an even deeper level. Here's what Henry talks about, what it means to be what he calls the beloved. And he, as I say, he uses this in talking about what Jesus experienced at his baptism. When the voice of God's Spirit said, "This is my Son, my beloved, the one whom I fully love." Here's Henry. "As the beloved, I can confront, console, admonish, and encourage without fear of rejection or need for affirmation. As the beloved, I can suffer persecution without desire for revenge, and receive praise without using it as a proof of my own goodness." I'm going to read that again. I mean, if any of us can get here, we'll be the best leaders possible. We will be the best leaders possible. I want you to listen to it again. As the beloved, meaning as we truly know who we are as the one called and loved and called forth by God, and that is our only identity. And that's why this is reference to baptism. Because baptism is always about identity. It's always about who really are you. "As the beloved, I can confront, console, admonish, encourage without fear of rejection or need for affirmation." You see, how do you get free from the fear of rejection when you need to say a hard but true word to someone? Yeah, how do you do that? Well, finally, only by knowing that you're the beloved. You know, that your identity doesn't depend on, in the end, how other people like you or not. Or how can you get free from this constant need for affirmation? I mean, all the studies show that every human being can't survive without affirmation. And you know, these studies show that if I say one thing to you that is a negative word, you did something wrong. I need to say five things to you about how great you are in order to compensate the one thing I've said that's negative. So, I mean, this human need for affirmation is tremendous. Yet, any good leader has to be free from the need of affirmation. I mean, you can't just do what you do because you get good strokes from other people. And how do you do that? By knowing one is the beloved. I can confront, console, admonish, and encourage without fear of rejection or need of affirmation. As the beloved, I can suffer persecution without the desire for revenge. And that's, you know, any leader is going to be accused of some things unjustly. I guarantee it. It's the way it works. And sometimes, the most important thing a leader has to do is simply absorb pain. Sometimes it's the single most important thing a leader has to do. There's no place else in the system for the pain to go. And the leader's got to absorb it. And not, you know, and not seek revenge. And receive praise without using it as a proof of my own goodness. You know, good leaders will get praised all the time. if that's what kind of makes you convinced that you're really a good and worthy person, again, you're going to fail in the end in your ability to be an effective leader. Okay, last thing. And then we'll have some... hopefully, we can get more of these points in discussion. When I wrote this little book, Leadership from Inside Out, the stuff I'm saying is in there. It was published by Crossroads Publishing. I sat and met with the marketing director when the book first came out, and we were talking about some ideas of marketing. And I said, well, you know, we could share this with Bob Schuller because I'm on his board. He's an RCA pastor. And she said, well, who's Bob Schuller? So the book didn't do real well. but there's a as I thought and wrote about this, I was thinking about these patterns of how leaders function in organizations, and one of the most important things that I've come to learn is that the role of a leader at any particular time in the life of an organization doesn't remain the same. Good leaders learn how to change their own roles because what an organization needs from a leader changes as the organization grows. And so the best leaders I know are the leaders who have the ability to give to organizations different things that they need at different stages in their life. The best example of this that you'd probably be familiar with, I don't want to step on any toes here, but you look at new church development pastors. The people who start new churches in my book are amongst they're the real pioneers. They're the most gifted, risky people I know. I've got fantastic respect for a person who can walk into a town and say, I think God's called me to start a new church here. Now, it's also true that any new church that gets started, in about 5 to 7 years, they enter into a crisis. It's practically by the book. And the reason is that the qualities of the new church development leader that were necessary to start the church aren't the same qualities that are able to take the church from where that church is when it's grown up to, you know, a level of maturity. It then needs a different kind of leadership to take it forward. And some new church start pastors, you know, I mean, they simply need to go out and start another church. There are other new church start pastors. I talked to one 2 days ago. He started a church, and he's pastoring it 21 years later. That's a remarkable leader. Because he's had to figure out how he changes his leadership style in relationship to an organization. It doesn't only involve with churches. I'm on the board of... I've been on board of different organizations. Some organizations that are new, some have been around a long time. And organizations, when they are new, they need charismatic leaders who are strong on vision, who project a kind of loyalty to what they want to do, and a lot of it's loyalty to the person, and they're able to really get something launched. And then when that organization gets launched, it's got to get to the point where the allegiance of those who are its members transfers from the founding leader to the mission and the vision itself. And then it has to get to a point where the values that have been taught begin to form and shape the culture of that organization. And then it goes into continual renewal if it succeeds. If it can't get through those stages, it ends up into one form of organizational crisis or another. Now, here's the point. I think I see something in Jesus that gives us a model for this. And I'll just throw this out and see what you think of it, and then we'll stop and have questions. Jesus begins his ministry in Luke 4. You know, what's he doing? He's giving forth his vision. I mean, you know, he's saying, this is what God's doing. This is what I'm called to. This is what it's all about. This is a powerful, powerful call to a vision. And then he begins calling people to himself. And when he calls the first disciples, they're basically attracted by Jesus. You know, they're coming because they want to follow Jesus. And then he begins to teach what is it going to be like to live in this new way. Well, it's the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount. It's the values. Teaches the values of what will shape this new way of being together. And then he tells these stories. The stories that he tells are parables, because they're stories that help people imagine what a different future will look like. And then he begins empowering. And he does this early. You know, in Luke 9, in Luke 10, when he sends out the 70, he first sends out the apostles, and then sends out the 70. He's not taught them the Lord's Prayer. They haven't been in Jerusalem yet. I mean, this is still in that stage where he's not only called them, but now he's empowering them to carry out the mission that he's declared. And then finally, in the journey to Jerusalem, and at the Last Supper, what does he do? He washes their feet. Which means he's giving all of his power away now. He's fully entrusting those whom he's called to now carry on what God has called them to. Now, I think you just think about that a little. I mean, in Luke 4, if Jesus had washed people's feet, it wouldn't have worked. You know, and you have all, in the church, you have all this stuff about leaders are visionary. No, leaders are servants. No, leaders are enablers. Oh, that terrible word. Leaders are this, leaders are that. But leaders in a church are different things at different times. Just like Jesus. You know, at certain points, leaders have to either have to put forth a vision or see that a core group embodies and embraces a vision. Leaders have to teach values. They have to see that a group really embraces the values that are necessary, the expected behaviors towards one another. Leaders have to tell the stories that help a group imagine a different future. Leaders have to then empower others to carry this out. And finally, leaders have to give themselves away. But you have to figure out when you do those things best in the life of an organization. That's what I think truly marks the way of a gifted leader. Okay, that's a lot in a brief time, but we've got at least
Well, we have at least 15 minutes for interaction. We could go on a lot more, but I'd love to hear your questions or reactions. Yes.
About this non-anxious presence.
Yeah.
Was just reading and studying Galatians with a group of lay leaders and noted that Paul's pretty anxious about a variety of things in there. And that was actually ended up being a focus of conversation. Just what is the place for some heightened level?
Yep.
I'm sure you don't mean some kind of passionless idea, but it still kind of left a number of people wondering. I mean, his language is so strong.
Yep.
It's crude. Is it just when the basics are threatened that we're allowed to be a bit anxious? Can you comment on that?
Sure. Well, Friedman says, one of the things that Friedman says is that no one gets to be a completely self-differentiated person. I mean, maybe you get 70-80% of the way there. And I think it's fair to say Paul was not a completely self-differentiated person. I mean, Paul brought his baggage into a lot of situations, and it's right there for us to see and to learn from.
He was young at the time.
You see me?
I say he was young.
Yeah, he was young. But it's a very good question. It's not saying there's no problem here. That's not what a non-anxious presence recognizes the severity of the issue, but doesn't allow oneself to be emotionally trapped and immobilized by it. So it's not a denial of the fact that there's high anxiety. In fact, a lot of people. I've got one person on staff whose constant refrain is, we're not going to be able to change this because the anxiety isn't high enough yet. There are some people who really say you can't get change in a system until your anxiety is to a high enough level. So let's deny anxiety, but it's rather how one acts and responds in the midst of a situation that produces a lot of anxiety for others.
It's hard to imagine the situation where a pastor today would, tell all the men to go all the way and emasculate themselves as a good leadership technique. Yet there we have Paul saying it.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. And I think, you get into hermeneutical questions finally here. But I personally am fascinated with Paul and with all the Scripture tells about, who he is. But I think you could also say, from what we learn from Scripture, I don't think the intent of Scripture is to sort of say everything that Paul did was right. I mean, Paul's not Jesus. We kind of can learn also from some of Paul's mistakes. Yes, and then here.
But this is more of a comment in light of some of this, okay? But just, I think the way I understand self-differentiated doesn't mean lack of emotions. It means
Correct.
Not being swayed by other people's
yep.
emotions, right? Like that's because I think it's so easy in leadership at times to think you're supposed to be unemotional. And I just don't think that works either. I think especially in congregational settings, I think you seem, I think that's the part you have to be careful. Like you don't look detached, right?
I think that's a very good word. It's not passivity, and it's not lack of emotion. People want to see a leader's passion.
Yeah.
They want to see what really makes a leader tick, and that because in the end, people want to follow courage. Mm-hmm. They really do, and so they want. But I would say I differ with one word, and that's detachment. I think that a good leader needs a degree of detachment. And that's not passivity, but it's rather that one of the best leaders I've ever known is Gordon Cosby, who is the pastor of church, the founding pastor of Church of the Savior. And I was a member there in Washington, D.C. He was my spiritual mentor for many years. And he's 91, and in December he just preached his last sermon. I was with Gordon at the. He came about a half year ago. Gave devotions at the board of directors for Sojourners. And his devotion, he talked. He said something really profound. He said, organizations today, Christian organizations, they need to focus on the essence of what they are and be clear about, you know, their core calling, their core purpose. And leaders need to have a spirituality that gives them enough detachment from the organization they lead so they could ask the most important questions of that organization. There's a way in which a non-anxious presence is also someone who has enough detachment. Like, I mean, if you're the leader of Hope College, Jim Bolden's a friend of mine, you know, I would say to Jim, you have to have enough detachment from your intense loyalty to Hope College to ask the most important questions that college needs to hear. So that's the only point in which I differ from your spot. Yeah.
That reminds me of the Buddhist principle of detached engagement. Mm-hmm. But I found in relationship to the anxiety matter, Peter Steinke talks about...
You want to speak up a little bit? So, Mark?
Peter Steinke writes about the importance about being the least anxious person in the room,
mm-hmm.
which gives some of us as anxious leaders a little more slack. But I think it's also truthful that we're not going to get rid of our anxiety.
Right.
If we can set a goal of being the least anxious one in the room, that lowers the bar for me in a way that's more attainable.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear that in the back? Yeah, and Steinke's work, he's the other one who's dealt a lot with the model of healthy systems. In fact, he's doing something at Western in a couple months, I think, and he's another one who's thought a lot about leadership systems and health. Yes?
Is there a line somewhere between being self-differentiated and being stubborn?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I think there is. Because you can take Friedman's work, and you could take everything he says, and then you could say, well, I mean, does this just mean, you know, someone is a stubborn, bullheaded person who doesn't listen to anyone, and that's not at all what Friedman is after. One thing that he stresses strongly is the deep importance of listening. And the deep importance of being in communication with all the voices in a system, and being able to really hear, but not hearing in such a way, you know how many of us are inclined, you listen to someone, you hear them, and you just want to give them the feeling that they're right. I mean, people used to say about Bill Clinton, everyone who ever talked to President Clinton felt that President Clinton agreed with him, because he had this tremendous kind of empathy, and a tremendous capacity to. What Friedman has emphasized, that people need to know where you stand. They don't just need to know that you understand where they stand. That's different than just a kind of a stubbornness that is unwilling to listen and unwilling to change. A self-differentiated person. A leader is a leader also who's very willing to change in the midst of a circumstance. So there is a difference between this and stubbornness. It's a very important question. Got that there and then here.
Can you say something about the actual gift of leadership? Do all of us in this room have the ability to lead?
Yeah.
And is everyone inherently able to lead an organization if we just practice these kind of things?
I think probably not, and that gets to there's a whole new discussion. There's a big discussion today around Ephesians 4, and around how we understand what gifts are given, and whether within the Reformed Church in America, that we have a group of pastors who are saying, the way we've recognized traditionally gifts, we haven't recognized what Ephesians 4 calls the apostolic gifts. And you have that language being used now that makes other people tremendously anxious and nervous, But I think the answer to your question is when you understand the way the New Testament talks about gifts, even if you avoid a kind of a totally, people try to make a total tit for tat equation between what's there and roles today. But I think there's enough there that really suggests that some persons are uniquely gifted to give overall leadership to churches, organizations in a way which others are gifted to give other kinds of contributions which are most needed. And figuring that out is pretty important. I think some persons are really, when you talk about the gift of prophecy, for instance, and how that's interpreted and understood, I think there are some voices that are most meant to always have a prophetic presence within the life of an organization, and that they're far better at that than they are in actual leadership. And I think that there are some gifts that are far better in administration than they are in leadership. And it is interesting that the New Testament specifies the gift of administration as a spiritual gift. And many organizations today, many churches today, there's a huge confusion between leadership and management, and those expectations get totally confused. And being clear about what is leadership and what is management and how each are terribly important, but they are not the same thing. That's an important distinction, and I think that's actually a New Testament distinction.
I was just thinking with respect to the question about stubbornness, stubbornness is still an anxiety reaction. I mean, it's simply the flip side of getting run over and agreeing with whoever shouts the loudest.
Yeah.
Just kind of, you're anxious about that, so you're just locked out. Either way, you still can't function.
Yeah, that's a good...
Being self-differentiated is really being able to move within the anxiety, not just to be swept away by it or just react to it. But being able to move, yeah, to kind of shape it, steer it,
that's
channel
right.
it, whatever.
That's a very helpful insight.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, sir.
Well,
and then Herb.
In respect to gifts, I've done several gifts inventories over the years.
Yeah.
And I have to say that by far the one that I found most helpful, both in terms of identifying gifts and in terms of helping people to embrace and accept or identify it as their gift, involved taking our community, which is the community of Christian graduate students, and people identifying what gifts they thought they had, and then looking to the rest of the community to see what gifts did the community see them as having.
There's absolutely, we didn't talk a lot about this. We mentioned it briefly in talking about Jesus, but it's absolutely the case that effective leaders, when you have vision and mission and values clear in an organization, then the single most important thing an effective leader does is figure out how to empower the gifts of others and identify those. And a lot of organizations, a lot of churches get tripped up exactly at that point. I'm dealing with an organization right now that has tremendous vision and mission, and it's doing fantastic stuff, but its staff feels absolutely disempowered because the leader's not been able to make that kind of transition.
Yeah. After Vietnam, the United States military was really radical as far as values and morals were concerned, and leadership was terribly broken.
Yeah.
And the best leadership that happened in the military at that time is some people made themselves marginal to the core system. A couple of people who are real fast trackers to be general officers said, we're going to go teach at Command and General Staff at the War College. So they marginalized themselves from that system. In some sense, Christ was that way to the Jewish community. I think now, and maybe John Newhouse and a few others are those kind of marginal people in the church today.
Yeah.
Can you identify some more of those?
Yeah, well, I think, in the life of the Catholic Church, when you go back, a few centuries, you find these interesting times when the Catholic Church is looking for a pope, and what do? They go to a monastery, I mean, you hardly think of that today, but in fact, I was talking to it was at the inauguration, I was talking to the Catholic Cardinal of Washington, and we got, we're one of these funny discussions where you're waiting for something to happen, and he and the Catherine Jefford Scorey of the Episcopal Church, the three of us were talking together, and we got into the discussion of why does the Pope wear white? Well, I got the answer. The answer is that there was, in the 15th or 16th century, a Pope Benedict who was chosen from the monastery. And when he became Pope, he decided he was going to keep his frock, his white frock, because he wanted to keep, he wanted to maintain the vows of his monastic life. And up until that time, popes wore all these fancy robes. From that time on, that's why popes wear white. Now, but the example is is one that's instructive. When you look for persons who can lead organizations, sometimes do you want to look totally outside the system to someone who's been formed and shaped in such a way they've made themselves marginal? But sometimes, because there's such ill health within the system, they bring health because they've made themselves marginal to the system and then can bring to the system what it most needs. Yeah. Well, it's 11 o'clock. I've enjoyed this. I hope it's been helpful for you. And thank you.